Faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today with Sarah Canoes about the Public Square Project. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi.
This is a one-story and 60-minute program, not like This American Life that's immediately to follow. And we're talking about your MFA project, your Master of Fine Arts project for the School of Art and Design here at the University of Illinois. What was it about?
Well, the Public Square was a project that attempted to experiment with a different model of public space, one that was created both in physical spaces with face-to-face encounters with people and also in the virtual realm over the internet and with low-power radio.
And when you say a different model for the Public Square, what is that in contrast to?
Well, there's been a lot of people who've decried the loss of public space in this country, and we could take that back probably at least 40 years, possibly even more, with various ideas about public space. A particularly influential person in this regard is Jürgen Habermas, who's a German philosopher, and he wrote a book called something about the public space, public sphere. And he had this idea that there had been, some point in the past, an idealized notion of the public sphere where individuals would come debate the significant issues of their time and reach some sort of disinterested conclusion that would be good for the entirety of society. And that has been steadily impoverished with the rise of mass media and the privatization of space and all those sorts of things. Now, there's a lot of things that may or may not be true about the idea that that ever existed in the past, but that notion of people coming together, discussing, and being able to take some sort of democratic action based upon those discussions, that was something that I was interested in experimenting with in a contemporary frame where not only the internet or radio becomes a platform for that kind of debate, but really face-to-face encounters remain equally important.
But wait a minute here, Sarah. I mean, you've mentioned philosophers and politics and communication theory, and aren't you an artist?
Yeah, that's what's great about being an artist. One of the great things about being an artist is that it's a very open field. Increasingly, people who do work that's seen as site-specific take less a particular location or the notion of having an object in a space, whether that a gallery space or a public plaza. And it's a little bit more about addressing a public and creating these experiential models and process models for other sorts of activities.
And is that your background? I mean, what kind of training did you bring to this particular project? I know you're a graduate of Yale University. What did you study there?
Sculpture.
Sculpture. So this sounds like a big move from sculpture.
Not so much. I mean, the work that I did as an undergraduate, work I did prior to coming to graduate school, was all, you know, much more traditional, object-oriented. However, I had a lot of experience as an activist as well. I lived in this town since 1998 and was actively involved with the School for Designing a Society and with the Independent Media Center. So I came at this change in my work that really took place right as soon as I got to graduate school with a sense of values for process, for dialogue, and for media. And this project I see as a really natural outgrowth of lots of things that I was doing and reading and thinking for years and years.
Well, why don't we give our listeners a little introduction to the project, since it was a project that involved recordings. Mm-hmm. We are able to have a little some snippets from the program. We have about a 4-minute segment that we can hear, and tell us what we're going to hear before we go to that.
Well, this particular piece is just the audio from a little documentation video that I put together about the project. I took 6 or 7 of the events. There were 23 events that took place over the course of the exhibition, one each day. Those usually took the form of a discussion, but frequently were other things like an exchange of used clothing with other people at Marketplace Mall, or a free giveaway of food that took place in Campus Town one day. This particular video just took photographs from those events and combined them with a little bit, a snippet of the sound. So it doesn't really give you a sense of what the project is. No documentation can ever do that. But it does give you a sense of how people came together and a little bit of what they talked about.
And you said these are field recordings. What does that mean?
Well, I had a wireless mic and would be recording people's conversations with a single wireless mic. And so frequently, you can hear a bus go by in the background. There's a lot of ambient noise. People wouldn't be speaking directly into the microphone. The recording was powered off a car battery, so sometimes you can hear the engine of the car, a little bits of clicking or static. So they're pretty dirty recordings.
All right. Well, let's listen to this example from the Public Square Project by Sarah Canoose.
Of every single human being is a fascist. Someone who wants to be controlled, someone who wants other people to make decisions for them, and someone who tends towards calling themselves a victim or someone who's passive. And there's also a desire in each of us to participate in the decisions that affect our lives. But sometimes people want to participate in what food they eat, but it's not always on the level of something overtly political.
I went to a barbecue, and an undergrad came up to me, and she said, "Oh, are you interested in joining our organization? We educate the campus about Israel." And I looked at her and said, "I don't think I'm who you want, because I kind of think Ariel Sharon is a war criminal." And the thing is that she looked at me with this open mouth. She could not conceive of being a Jew and thinking Ariel Sharon was a war criminal.
If George Bush gets his way, they could have came in and arrest us and throw us in jail and kill us right now.
I came to watch softball, not listen to your political speech.
My favorite teaching method would be hands-on. I like experimenting with stuff and stuff I've never done, like cooking or like dissecting squids and stuff like that.
He was in prison for 12 years, and he actually had gone back at another point. And it was amazing, because all of a sudden, he became so much more real when he said, "I have a daughter that's your age, and I've never met her." And for me, that was just like, ugh. You know, I mean, the idea that all of a sudden I wasn't just a stranger, and the fact that he was revealing the fact that there were a lot of people probably in this world that although he served his time, would still not give him the opportunity.
The public should be able to reclaim part of that cost somehow by taxing the use of the commercial use of publicly acquired knowledge.
I think voluntary poverty is part and parcel of the revolution of the kingdom, because the fact is we're all around the world fighting these wars. I mean, Bush said it himself, for our way of life.
I mean, when I try to write things, I'm cognizant of the fact that I will have readers, and I want it to be palatable to my readers. I want to be able to tell the story in a way that's going to reach as wide an audience as possible. Even if I'm saying something they're not used to hearing, especially if I'm saying something they're not used to hearing, I'm trying to write a screed about how evil scabs are right now, and I can't write it because I'm so mad at scabs that I can't write it in a way that anybody who doesn't agree with me is going to be able to read it.
I find it fun that I'm sitting here on the property of Sinclair Broadcasting when one of the last pieces that I ran was on Sinclair Broadcasting.
In the arts that I run in, the more an artwork becomes about the idea and not about a material specificity, the less, the more difficult it is to hold up intellectual property and ownership to it, and yet the less stakes there are, so it doesn't really matter. There's not many artworks that are idea-based as opposed to sort of material object-based, for which people are scrambling to give money. So it doesn't really matter.
Work on story ideas, and when we get together next week...
Sandra said she would write, she would like to write something about
Does anyone else want to spoke? Do we have a theme?
Yeah.
No one wants to spoke. it's only once a month at 8 o'clock. The first day of the month.
From the Public Art Project that Sarah Canoose has been working with here at the University of Illinois as part of her Master of Fine Arts program. You've completed that project now, and you say it was an exhibition of 23 events, and what we've just been listening to are just very small segments from each of those. How long would most of them go?
Oh, I think the shortest one was about half an hour. The longest would have been around two hours.
Okay. And help me and the listeners understand your understanding of what an exhibition is.
Well, this project actually has several layers. Imagine, if you will, a square. I built the project around the structure of a square, with two of the corners being physical locations and two of them being non-physical locations. So starting out with the most recognizable physical location where art might be, a gallery.
Hmm.
For the MFA program, we're expected to participate in a thesis exhibit at the end of our 3 years, and we're giving space in the Krannert Art Museum. So starting there, I decided I'm going to put an installation there, but I want to question how much this public museum is a public space, and possibly give people the opportunity to make it more of a public space. So I had a 24-hour web stream of all the sound in the museum that was collected by a square, physical square of microphones. That also was broadcast for 12 hours per day.
So that would be people's comments as they see art, respond to art, as well as the guards walking by or the professors or whatever.
Okay. And oftentimes it was actually the sound of other projects in the exhibit because there's quite a little bit of audio and video work that was going on there. So if you actually, you know, I would look at these recordings afterwards and you'd see the audio waveform and there'd be like this. It looked like a little bit of a heartbeat because somebody had a piece that chimed every so many seconds, and that was the most noticeable sound in the museum. So that was happening in that one physical space. And then sort of mirroring that on the opposite side of this conceptual square were these floating temporary spaces. So every day, different time every day, for an hour or 2 hours or so, people would gather in spaces around the city in order to have a discussion, have a meal, do something that was more participatory and a little bit more democratic than the sort of passive spectatorship that often happens in museums. Those were also broadcast. Those events were also broadcast over low-power radio. And the two of sound was combined and archived on a website, and the website formed the third corner of the square. So all of the information about the project can be actually found online. The site is still up. It's www.thepublicsquare.net. And then on the opposite side of that, the second or last virtual corner of the square, is the radio broadcasts themselves.
Sarah, you used the word an installation when you're talking about what went on at the Krannert Art Museum as part of this project. What's an installation for some listeners who may not know?
Well, everyone sort of knows what a sculpture looks like, or, you know, has a sense of this autonomous object sort of in the center of the room, or we know what a painting or drawing looks like. It's something that hangs on the wall. Installation arts are not really either of those things. They are oftentimes objects or environments that aren't the craft and the creation of an individual object for looking at or for aesthetic contemplation is made a little bit more more of an environment, so oftentimes a little bit more conceptual. It's about a space where, you know, meaning is created. Sometimes they're extremely beautiful installations, but oftentimes they'll incorporate found objects, ordinary objects, for the creation of a room-like space.
But it's a creation of one artist or a group of artists who've created this.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. We're talking with Sarah Canass about her public square project at the university, and I want to invite listeners who have a comment or question to call us. You may want to jot down these numbers in case we raise an issue you want to comment on later. In Champaign-Urbana, the numbers is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you punch in those numbers, that will access several local lines. Anywhere else the program is heard, including on the Internet, you may call us within the continental U.S. free, 1-800-222-9455. So the toll-free line is 1-800-222-WILL. Well, let's get back to thinking about what happened during the recording that we just shared with listeners. At first, there was comments about Palestine and Israel, Ariel Sharon. There was discussion of politics being appropriate at a softball game, mm-hmm. The whole issue of prisoners, scabs. How did you select what to talk about and who to invite to be on the air?
Well, it was going to be an incomplete process. Anytime you try to model anything, anytime you're experimenting with social forms, are necessarily incomplete. So I sort of worked with what I had and who I knew and who people I knew, and these circles of involvement, a network of sorts was formed. I've been involved in a lot of things locally in town for a number of years, so I know a number of people who'd be interested in doing this kind of thing. And sometimes we went unprepared into a space like at the softball game and started talking to people who were at the softball game. And other times it was something that I orchestrated pretty tightly. I invited people to create events for the project. And then at times I also went to events that were already happening anyway. So at the very beginning of the recording, you hear from the Take Back the Night March, which was very much about women making a claim to a physical public space as a safe space to be.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much did your personal interests, your personal philosophy, your personal politics affect what you wanted to create?
Oh, very much. I care very much about the ways that people participate in our culture. And I wanted to create an environment and a project in which participation was maximized and a network of people who knew about the project and were involved in the project would continue to grow. I also was thinking about this in light of what might be sustainable. So some of these events, which may have happened once, they also folded into desires that other people had for creating longer standing programs in town. So for example, the free food giveaway that we gave was the very first time that a Food Not Bombs program had ever been tried here, at least to my knowledge, and that they've been doing weekly servings to people, anyone who wants food, people who need it, who don't have the money to buy food, and then also anyone who happens by. And that's largely a youth-led initiative. Most of the people who are involved are under 18, and they've been feeding people every week since then.
Where does that happen and when?
That is actually happening right now at Skelton Park, which is on the corner of Washington and First Street in Champaign.
And who are the youth that are doing this, and where does the food come from?
The food is acquired from sort of surplus food, either things that stores would be getting rid of or individuals would be getting rid of.
And from the local food bank as well?
No, it's actually all
individual.
Mm-hmm, it's all found. And the youth are, people from a number of schools. There's quite a few uni high schools. Students represented a few homeschoolers.
And for people who may be hearing this who are in need of food, they can go there and get food free?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Washington Park?
Skelton Park.
Skelton Park, I'm sorry. It's set on the corner of Washington and...
And First Street.
And First.
It's right near the Time Center.
Uh-huh. The Time Center is a homeless center in Champaign-Urbana. Now, where did your values come from? I mean, you said this project partly was an expression of your values, but how did your personal ones develop?
I think that if you had asked that question to my mother, she'd say something that I'd always been like that. I credit my parents very much with the formation of my sense of justice. And it's been wonderful as I've gotten older to be engaged more in a dialogue with them, so that I feel at this point that they're learning from me and I'm learning from them. But they've been tremendously supportive and challenging people of me and of the rest of the world. My father does HIV/AIDS policy research and has been very active in trying to improve the way that we as a society deal with people who are at risk of getting HIV and AIDS, and sort of removing the stigma that causes so many people to become sick and prevents them from being able to access the medical care. My mother has been very active in the Episcopal Church in peace and justice work and in education work through them.
Hmm. Your parents are in California?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you grew up?
Yes.
What part?
Southern California in North Hollywood, which is part of Los Angeles in the San Fernando Valley.
Mm-hmm. How did you go from there to Yale?
In high school, it's sort of the thing that you did. You went to college. And I figured, I got into Yale. I can't not go.
And how did you choose sculpture and art at Yale?
Oh, well, I actually had gone to Los Angeles County High School for the Arts, which is an alternative high school with intensive arts preparation. Mm-hmm. And that was a wonderful experience.
Was that your choice or your parents?
That was my choice. Hmm. I wanted to get out of regular schools mm-hmm. very, very much. Hmm. So I knew I wanted to pursue art, but I also wanted to get the benefits of a university and didn't want to go to an arts college where very little other sorts of academic preparation would be expected. So I didn't apply to any art colleges. I applied to liberal arts schools.
But you wanted to get out of regular colleges, and then you went to 4 years of Yale and now 3 years of an MFA program at the University of Illinois, and now you're still teaching.
I wanted to get out of regular high school, not colleges.
So you responded in a different way to Yale and here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I didn't enjoy Yale very much. Hmm. I very much felt like an outsider there. And there are a lot of, I think universities are heterogeneous places. There's people doing a lot of different kinds of work, and they're often deeply conflicted in contradictory sorts of work.
You're teaching now a course called Art and Social Movements.
That's
Tell
right.
us about that.
Well, this is an undergrad-level class. There's quite a few grads actually taking it as well. It's interdisciplinary. There's students from psychology, dance, library school, as well as art. And what we're trying to do is create a space to both make and learn about the history of political arts in this country and to try to develop a framework for really dealing with it critically. Very frequently, activists see activist or political art as being necessarily either a mural or a poster, and artists see any work that deals with politics as somehow less than other sorts of arts that are supposed to be autonomous and transcendent and this beautiful thing that you look upon. So we're trying to figure out, but within that great middle ground, where we might want to set down some criteria and some ways of evaluating and being self-critical about the work that we make.
And notice I've been very careful not to ask you to somehow pigeonhole art or even to define it. But in talking about its characteristics for you, it seems that it includes almost everything.
Well, I think that there are many things that one could consider from the frame of art. Like, art is a tradition. And like any tradition, it has its baggage.
People can study art history.
People can study art history. Right. And the history of art, when it's brought to bear on a certain project, allows you to think about it in a certain way and prevents you from thinking about it in other ways. So one of the things that I've liked to do is to try to maintain a pretty loose relationship with that word, because sometimes it's the least possible word, the useful word to use.
Mm-hmm. But when you talk about political art, you're talking about art having an effect on people's real lives.
Yeah.
And when you're feeding people, I suppose it's very obvious. Mm-hmm. But also I take it when you talk about conceptual art, that affects the way people think and feel.
Well, I think that's the hope at any rate. I think that much of the way that our society is structured is based upon metaphors, and it's based upon a sort of unstated agreement or an unstated internalization and understanding of certain rules that we live by. And I think where the possibility for a public serving of food to people, for that to become art, it's because it starts to address some of those metaphors that we live by, metaphors and tacit understandings that food is a commodity, that it's something that people need to buy, and that you're able to afford it because you work and you're participating in a particular system. And so if we step back from thinking about it as these people are feeding certain people in this place at this time, which might be sort of a social work type of affair, and think about what are some of the social implications, that might be where thinking about it as art becomes helpful.
How much of your project, your art project, the Public Square Project, is countercultural?
Hmm. I think the thing that was surprising to me in working on it is that there was people have a certain sense of rightness in doing these kinds of activities, which is something that actually came as quite a surprise to me. People feel that they have a right to let their voice be heard, and they have a right to engage with certain questions and issues in the locations in which meaning about those is usually made and usually not addressed. So, you know, locations like the mall where meaning about clothes and commodities are made but never questioned. People feel good about doing that. So, for example, when we were at the mall, there was a group of children probably ranging in age from about 3 to about 16 or 17 waiting for the bus. They all wanted to join. They all sat down and started looking through the clothes and took a few things, and there was nothing that seemed wrong to them. So even when the security guard came up and asked us what we were doing, he was so confused. He didn't ask us to leave. He just looked at us like, I've never heard of that before. So I think that labeling something as countercultural is an isolating thing. It erects a separation between the people who do that culture and the people who don't.
Let me encourage listeners again to give us a call if you'd have a question or like to make a comment in our talk with Sarah Knaus this afternoon. The toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. You may call us at 333-9455. And we do have a caller on line 4. Let's include this person in our conversation. Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. Sarah Knaus. Back in 1973, Arthur K. Bierman published a tract on the good life, consummation, neighborhoods, the arts, and their detrivialization, work, leisure, and an art force entitled The Philosophy of Urban Existence, Ohio University Press, Athens, Ohio, 1973. Has Bierman influenced your work, and if so, how?
Well, you know, I'm not familiar with that particular book, but that sounds like something I'd be interested in. Thanks for the recommendation.
We appreciate the call, and we have another caller on line 1, one of our local lines. You're on the air. Please go ahead. Yes, line 1.
Yes. I've been looking at protest in public space for a number of years, and it seems to me that what the guest is doing is very important, but may possibly benefit from a couple of other dimensions that have gone unmentioned. Pardon me. The first one is that after the civil rights and anti-war movements in the 1960s, there were a whole series of district and Supreme Court decisions that defined the public forum and laid out a quite elaborate set of criteria for what that means. Traditionally, it's been sidewalks, streets, parks, plazas, squares, and the like. But one of the things that happened in all those decisions is that it gave authorities the right to limit protest or First Amendment exercise in terms of the time, place, and manner, so that they could relocate protest perhaps away from the eyes and ears of the people who were the targets of the protesters' attempts to redress grievances. The second thing is that I think you've kind of touched on this because you've been doing work at the mall, is that increasingly people are congregating not in those traditional public places, but in places like ballparks, sports arenas, and malls, which are no longer really part of the public forum. They're privately organized, controlled, regulated, and the like. And I don't know if the guest would like to respond to that or not. And I would like to know where I could get in touch with her to send her copies of some of the work that we've done that touch on these kinds of issues.
Well, I'll give you my my project email address. Would that be sufficient for that?
Oh, yes, that'd be fine.
It's info at thepublicsquare.net. So you can get in touch with me that way. And I think the caller raises a lot of really great points, and there are a lot of things that I was thinking about in putting the project together. Sort of to, I guess I'm working backwards with the comments.
Sure.
To think about the notion of the private public space, I think that's absolutely essential. I took a really open and expansive view of the word public. Because it is such a very, very over-theorized, not that people should stop theorizing about it, but many people have, and very heavily litigated question. And I wanted to think about public space in the most open possible way. So things that people would think of were public in some sense, as in a place where people go and they're not in private, locations that are actually publicly owned even if they are relatively strictly controlled. So, for example, labs at the university would qualify as that. They're technically owned by the state, but they're oftentimes heavily privately funded and very heavily guarded. So the way that I thought of public was very expansive and very fluid. And as for what is the limits of permissible discourse, both and activities, both in these private public spaces, semi-public spaces, and in the traditional, typical public square sidewalk, I think I've you know, in a lot of the protest activity that I've been involved in, been very interested in that exactly where that line is. For example, with the School of the Americas protest, there's if you cross a very particular line, you're suddenly trespassing and arrestable. And so the effectiveness of the protest is due to crossing that, to trying to get inside. And where that line is something that is very strictly laid down in some places and less strict in others. These sorts of activities weren't protests in an identifiable sense. A few of them were permitted marches or protests like the Take Back the Night March. I also went to the Prospect for Peace. And I didn't want them to be protests because I sort of wanted to figure out a way of getting around the large the tradition of the large-scale march and the confrontation, and to figure out ways of sort of infiltrating figuring out a way of getting into the cracks of those traditions.
Let me reintroduce our guest. We're about halfway through our program here on Keeping the Faith this Sunday afternoon. We're talking with Sarah Knaus about the Public Square Project, which was her Master of Fine Arts thesis project here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. We'll be getting back to Sarah and other callers in a minute or two. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program, and I'm the director of the University YMCA, which is the oldest continuous student organization at the university. It was started in 1873 by undergraduates, and the Y has been involved in providing opportunities for students to do social action and community service for the last 132 years now here at this university. The Y is a 501c3 charity. We are not supported by the university or by government funds. We survive by the kindness of people who have helped support the Y over the years. One of the ways we receive support these days is by accepting automobiles, trucks, or motorcycles, believe it or not. If people would like to make a contribution, they can do that. If they itemize their taxes, they get a tax deduction by donating to this particular charity. And we sell these cars and trucks and motorcycles often to students and others who appreciate getting something that's still workable at a good price. Right now, incidentally, we have a 1977 Lincoln Continental. It's not a good student car, but maybe someone listening would like to restore it as a museum piece, a installation perhaps, Sarah, one of the last of the huge gas guzzlers. But it's a very interesting car with leather upholstery and a Bose sound system, as I recall. So if you're interested in either donating a car or interested in perhaps purchasing that Lincoln Mark V two-door, give me a call during business hours starting Tuesday this week at the Y, 337-1500. My name again is Steve Shoemaker.
This is a silly little aside, but
yes,
I
please.
Learned to drive on a 68 Buick Electra.
About the same size,
right? Yes. I thought I was going to run over the houses on either side of the road because it was so wide.
Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, we'll be talking with a poet, Jean Murray Walker, who is a professor of English at the University of Delaware. Her most recent book of poetry has been published by the University of Illinois Press as part of the Illinois Poetry Series, edited by Lawrence Lieberman. Her most recent book is out just this spring, called A Deed to the Light. And in preparation of Professor Walker's being our guest next week here on Keeping the Faith. I've been reading a poem of hers each week here for the last month or so. And today I'd like to read another selection from this book, A Deed to the Light, with the permission of the poet, of course, as well as the Illinois Press. This is a short poem called Grasshopper by Jean Murray Walker. When I come upon the grasshopper on the porch, he lies nose down, silent, looking not like a body so much as some great damage, like a car wreck. But I know it wasn't an accident. Deciding it needed to be done was the hard part. He thought about it for a long time. He loved his leg, but it was broken, and how could he grow another until he got rid of the first? One morning he felt a tickle he knew might be the new leg trying to sprout. Carefully, he pulled out of his long grief and took the first bite. The poem Grasshopper by Jean Murray Walker from her recent book, A Deed to the Light, by University of Illinois Press, read by permission here on Keeping the Faith. Well, back to our guest today, Sarah Canoose. Jean Murray Walker will be our guest next week, but today we have an artist, next week a practicing poet. We also have a caller waiting to speak to our guest on line one. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I was just calling. I've enjoyed listening to the guest's conversation about her integration of politics and art and sort of the relationship that seems to always exist between the two. And I call to ask how Sarah would characterize her political beliefs, and also why it is she, if you'd agree with me, that artists tend to consider themselves liberal, and why, well, what it is about liberalism that attracts artists.
Well,
appreciate the question. Thank you very much.
I think I would call myself a small D Democrat. I believe in democracy, and I would like to have people have more of a say in the decisions they have a stake in. So most of the things that I do kind of spring from that core belief. I don't know necessarily if I would agree with a caller that artists tend to be liberal or sort of on the left side of the spectrum. For a couple of reasons, while many artists might, you know, vote in a generally liberal sort of way, there's this thing called the umbilical cord of the bourgeoisie, which is that artists often really, really need the existence of very wealthy patrons in order to purchase their work. And oftentimes that relationship is one of extreme dependency, and I think it causes many artists to create things or to fail to take political action that might jeopardize that the position of the people who support them.
You're mentioning that artists are dependent upon people appreciating their work enough to pay for it to survive, or at least a patron who wants to help them continue to create. Can be true for musicians as well as of visual artists, other conceptual artists, other kinds of artists. But your project is free for anybody to look at, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's available on the web. You gave us a website where anybody who has access to that can go to thepublicsquare.net and experience what you created. But you were sort of supported in this by the fact that you have a teaching assistantship from the university. Tax money is going to support you. That's sort of a pretty conservative thing, isn't it?
Well, we're all dependent. Uh-huh. You know, we're all very much dependent. I think that there's I don't want to oversimplify it, but there is a sort of split in if you were to look at the art world, and there's a really strong discourse in the art world right now, argument for beauty and for the creation of very beautiful objects. I think that's a little bit different than trying to use grant money or trying to use loan money in order to support the creation of these kind of, you know, ugly and messy sort of social circumstances. I think some of that conversation about beauty has underneath it as its structure a very conservative view of what the role of art is, that art should be an object for individual contemplation. It's something that should be owned. It's mm-hmm. something that brings cultural capital to the owner. And so that's kind of the realm of conservatism that I'm sort of thinking about. How does that art object relate to social prestige, to ownership?
Let me carry the last questioner's comment a little bit farther. What are you going to do next? Once you graduate from here, mm-hmm. how will you support yourself in doing what you seem called to do and have talents to mm-hmm. do?
I'm really struggling with that right now. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I am planning on moving to Chicago in the fall. I don't know entirely what I'll do. I am planning on doing some freelance writing. I'm also looking at working in the nonprofit sector, which mm-hmm. I did before going to graduate school. I would love to teach. I love teaching, mm-hmm. and I'm hoping that I'm able to find something that way.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of just your personal experience, mm-hmm. are you supported? I mean, I'm not saying it well, but is your family in favor of you doing this? Because I know, as a parent myself of someone about your age, when I think of my daughter struggling mm-hmm. as a social worker just to make enough money to live, to do what she feels called to do, to be helpful to people, you know, I worry about her. Mm-hmm. Are your parents okay with your taking this task?
My parents have given me a very, very, very long leash mm-hmm. since I was young. Mm-hmm. And I come from an upper middle class background, and I know that if I were to need something, my parents would be able mm-hmm. to bail me out. I recognize that if I came from a less financially secure background, I probably wouldn't be able to do this because I would have to worry about taking mm-hmm. care of my parents
sure.
as they age. I'm very fortunate in that way. Uh-huh. I'm trying to figure out ways of sharing that privilege. My parents are extremely supportive. I haven't ever asked them for money to help me. I've been able to figure it out mm-hmm. up till now. My needs are pretty slight.
Have you had patrons?
No.
No.
I've sold some work, but uh-huh. not recently.
Uh-huh. We're talking with Sarah Knaus here on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. If listeners, this is a live call-in program, and if listeners have a question, please call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, there are several local lines, 333-9455. We'll get you to those local lines, and we have someone on line one. Yes, go right ahead with your question, please.
Yes, I have one question. Do you think it's important to have a practical outlet, because, you know, artists are poor by nature, to have a practical outlet? I have a friend who is artistic and makes all kinds of money through her art, but do you think it's important to have a practical outlet and to justify your artistic endeavors? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
In addition to being an artist, Sarah, do you think you need to have a trade?
A trade? Well, I'm hoping that teaching, traditionally teaching has sort of fulfilled that role, particularly since art has become sort of professionalized and there's
right.
universities that grant degrees in it and mm-hmm. programs in that. I sometimes bemoan the fact that oftentimes artists who really want to be artists take up teaching as a side thing, and I think that that's really doing a disservice to themselves and the students. But that is often the way that these things are fundable, that some living can be eked out.
Mm-hmm. You have brought us also a bit of a recording of a project you did a little earlier before you started this Public Square project that has a connection with our day today, since it's July 4th that this program is being broadcast. Tell us what we're about to hear.
Well, 2 years ago at the 4th of July parade, the theme was A Free People, A Free Press. And I decided I wanted to go to the parade and talk to people who were spectators and see what they had to say about the parade's theme and what they thought about it. So I had me and I think there were two other interviewers who were there. And based upon interviews with 20-odd people, I put together a series of six 2.5-minute sound collages that each take one of the sort of main questions. At this point, I can't remember what the main questions were. But we can listen to
All right,
to
well, let's listen to the first one, and this is for about 2.5 minutes.
Well, the general public has never much cared about telegrams. Now, I don't mean people. I mean the public.
I think free press is good, you know, I think we should have free press. I mean, everybody has the right to know what's going on in the world, and people obviously need to get that out there.
Press that no political organization has any say-so when they print a story to quash it or tell them to write it otherwise.
Free press means that individuals and organizations have the right to report and interpret the news without fear of repercussion.
I guess a free press is the ability of people to write and say what they want with reasonable guarantees that it's not going to hurt people.
Well, for one thing, I think a free press is a responsible press. And I think that some people confuse freedom with license to do anything or to print anything or to violate all kind of ethical standards. And I don't believe that. I think with freedom comes a certain responsibility.
Way of getting out information that doesn't restrict what's written, but it allows people to express themselves.
Free press is telling the people what they need to hear, not what they want to hear, and not making the truth nice, nothing, tell it like it is.
The term free press was probably coined by someone with money to make the people without money feel like they had a free press. The press is in the hands of people with money, and the people without money have no say whatsoever.
We've got to have more chances to be able to say what we feel.
No, Mom's talking.
No, Mommy's talking. I think we do need to have more of that.
Well, the public square represented in the 4th of July parade and interviews during it by Sarah Knaus and friends. Tell us about how it felt to do that. Did people tend to respond positively? Here you are in the Midwest and you come up with a microphone, put it in front of their faces and ask them a question. How'd they respond?
Well, the people who agreed to be interviewed responded fine.
What was your percentage?
Oh, probably about 60%.
Really?
You know, quite a few people, you know, they just wanted to watch the parade. Mm-hmm. The idea of turning a space of spectatorship into a space of commentary, it's not always popular, but but people do, you know, oftentimes people feel like they want to say something and they don't have the opportunity.
Mm. And how did you choose this topic, these questions?
They were pretty open-ended questions, asking people, what is a free press? You know, do we have one? The questions sort of followed pretty easily from one another. The parade 2 years ago, if listeners will recall, was to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the News Gazette, which, of course, is our only newspaper, only daily newspaper in town, and is actually owned by, at the time, a woman who's now deceased. So the questions of you know, what is free in a context of a monopoly, mm-hmm. privately owned mm-hmm. situation, and also all of the things that have been going on for the last many years with the Federal Communications Commission. We weren't directly addressing either of those things at the parade, but that was very much a backdrop for the project.
Hmm. You mentioned earlier in response to one of the questions from a caller that part of what you've been involved with in terms of art and the public and politics is infiltration. Now, in what sense are you infiltrating when you do this kind of a thing?
Well, we, many people have, and myself included somewhat, have gotten pretty discouraged with the traditional model of public protests because it's become either more and more violently suppressed or simply rendered irrelevant because the media don't pick up it, or there's a small photograph on page 16 of a protest, or it's kept far, far, far away from the activity that it's actually intended to disrupt. And the function of power has become so diffuse as well with transnational financial market transactions, telephone conferencing, all of these sorts of things, that this big protest of a building or a place where this event is supposed to be happening, I think, is maybe a little bit less useful than it has been in the past. However, because of this general dispersal of the activities of power structure, I think we need to have a general dispersal of the activities of people who are questioning the way that that power operates. And so when I use the idea of infiltration, or another metaphor that I use often is the virus, where it sort of becomes a self-replicating thing that moves through society, that's kind of what I'm talking about, trying to figure out a way of decentralizing the process of questioning and creating other discourse and creating other networks and organizations.
Are you working for social change?
Yes, very much.
And what's stopping you?
What is stopping me?
What are the barriers that you have to get over as an artist, as someone who's a communicator, who's trying to change public opinion or motivate people to move in a certain direction? What are the biggest things that you've experienced in this project that's trying to stop you?
I think probably the biggest thing is apathy, or and a sense of resignation. I think at this point in history, people are really, really discouraged. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that there are many people who think things are going well, regardless of whether they would describe themselves as conservative or liberal or progressive or radical even. And I think that that can be a very, very self-defeating phenomenon. I've discovered over the last couple of years, it's become increasingly difficult to get people to show up to events, whether they're rallies or meetings.
Robert Putnam's book, for example.
Yeah. And I think people are exhausted. Mm-hmm. And we have tremendously bad economic times. People are working more than they've ever worked before. I think I heard on WILL a few days ago that the average family or average worker works over 48 hours a week now. So there's a lot of individual barriers to participation. And I think that that's probably one of the biggest hurdles that anyone involved in social change work is facing.
You mentioned that one of your goals as a change agent, as an artist, mm-hmm. as a change agent, is justice. How did you choose justice as opposed to other possible goals, virtues, whatever?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I completely understand your question.
Well, I guess what is it about the focus on justice? How did that grab you? How did that cause you to get involved in movements of social change and using your art to do that?
Well, I think that in politics we often hear about issues. We know about the issue of abortion, and we know about the issue of corporate tax evasion, and we know mm-hmm. about the issue of logging in the redwoods, and we know about the issue of rainforest, and we know about the issue of IMF, World Bank loans. But what connects all of those things is a certain institutionalized set of practices that are sometimes informal, sometimes not informal, that make some people have more power than others. And so that, to me, is a fundamentally unjust mm-hmm. way of being. And so to cast your lot with trying to write that, it allows you to change your issue focus dependent on what context you're in, what community you choose to embed yourself in. But the underlying goals remain the same.
What brought you to Champaign-Urbana? Was it the program here in the arts, or were you here and then just learned about that?
I was here and I learned about that.
You said you were involved in the Independent Media Center. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
The Independent Media Center is a grassroots sort of DIY journalism center. It's located at 218 West Main in downtown Urbana, and about 4 years ago now, wow, a group of people started meeting in a friend's living room and talked about how we might be able to start one of these things here. They had the first Independent Media Center was started in Seattle at the time of the WTO protests in November of 1999. The idea was to decentralize and to diversify the sorts of media representations of those protests, recognizing that the corporate media would not represent the protesters' views or experiences accurately or representationally. They decided to create a way for the protesters to document their own story and to distribute that through a website. About 9 months later, we started our own independent media center, some people who had actually gone to the protests in Seattle and learned a little bit about that model. And since then, we've grown to be one of the most comprehensive. We've had a permanent physical space for 3.5 years. We have a weekly one-hour radio broadcast on WEFT, Mondays at 5:30. A website.
And you have a budget?
The budget is entirely dependent upon donations and some money that we're able to raise because we have a nonprofit status and we help other media makers achieve grants. And so we take like a small service fee if we do fiscal sponsorship for that grant.
Let me repeat the website that's available for people who want to learn about your particular project, thepublicsquare.net. And if people would like to communicate with Sarah Knaus about that or other items she's brought up on the program today, they may reach her at info, at the Public Square. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Very good. Tell us about low-power radio. You chose to use that as a way to communicate your Public Square project. What is it?
Well, low-power radio is regular FM radio, but with a low power signal. I don't know what the signal strength of WILL is, but
5,000.
It's, you know, 4 or anything that's under, you know, that will actually blanket an area. Right now, there is a low power, permanent low power radio station that has received a license from the FCC a few years ago. They decided to license these low power stations. And a group in town, Radio Free Urbana, has started up, and they're going to be operating a very grassroots sort of station, similar to WEFT, but lower power, based in Urbana.
Well, I want to thank our guest, Sarah Knaus, for talking with us today. She's a graduate of Yale University and soon to be a graduate with a Master of Fine Arts at the University of Illinois after she finishes teaching this last course, Art and Social Movements, here at the University this summer. I want to thank also our callers with the comments and questions for today. Next week on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be Jean Murray Walker, the poet whose work I've been reading for the last several weeks. We'll be talking with her by phone. That's July 11th at 5 o'clock Central Time. Later in July, we'll be talking with David Eisenman about a Christian view of U.S. prison policy. We'll be talking with Cindy Shepherd about The Preacher as Minor Poet, with Father Paul Pluth about Mary in church life. Joel and Barry Schweitzer will be our guest August 22nd, talking about Jewish education. I want to thank listeners for making suggestions to me about some of those programs coming up, and happy to hear other suggestions. You may reach me at steve@universityymca.org, online, or call me at 337-1500 during the week with suggestions for future programs here on Keeping the Faith. A reminder about the Y Dump and Run program. We will be accepting things July 10 for Dump and Run. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Gore Vidal had a special fondness for the Founding Fathers, especially George Washington.
The others were geniuses. He was not a genius, but he had a powerful character, which got him through the Revolution, since he was not much of a general, but he was a great leader.
I'm Jim Fleming. We'll talk with Gore Vidal next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7, here on WILL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmont; Thrifty Nickel, Champaign; and GCOM Incorporated in Savoy. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
We remember Abraham Lincoln as one of the great presidential orators, yet little has been written about the speech that took him from local Illinois politician to viable national candidate. It was delivered in New York, and many expected him to fail. Instead, the speech was a triumph, and the public relations campaign that followed helped secure the presidential nomination. Monday on Focus 580, you'll hear an archive interview with Harold Holzer, author of Lincoln at Cooper Union, the speech that made Abraham Lincoln president. I'm David Inge, the host, Focus 580, Monday at 11, here on WILL Urbana. Anna.